Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Open Talk Radio, 313 The Flash.
However and whenever it is you may be listening, thank you for stopping into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy radio show live here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash, and starting right now, live on YouTube. So shout out to everybody here on our YouTube channel. We've got a fantastic show planned for you today. For those who subscribe to the Take It Easy podcast, y'all know our friend Chris from over at 10 Sports. Chris was kind enough to join us to talk about the Tennessee Titans over the past couple days, and boy, are we glad to have him around here and doing all of the great stuff that he does for us every now and then, popping in to talk about the Tennessee Titans. So with the Julio Jones news breaking, we wanted to break down some X's and O's with him. Y'all seem to respond well to LeGarrette Blount last week, and we've got a lot of great people who come on with Take It Easy, and sooner or later we'll bring some of those over to the radio platform. But for the time being, we will chat with our buddy Chris from 10 Sports about the Julio Jones trade, more of an X's and O's breakdown, and hopefully we gain a good bit of information out of that. But we begin today's show with a tad bit of breaking news coming in here today. Maybe big news, maybe not confirmed news, but at the very least, rumors are beginning to swirl about a 12-team college football playoff here in motion. According to Sports Illustrated, in a statement expected to be released today, we are planning on the NCAA proposing a 12-team college football playoff to the competition, I think competition committee. I know competition committee is the NFL, but I don't know if college football has one of those. Anyways, so what the situation looks like is that we may be on our way to a 12-team college football playoff, or at least the proposal being sent in. And maybe it won't be next year. Maybe it'll be a little bit later than that. But at the very least, the foundation is being laid for a college football playoff that is expanded to 12 teams. And the timing of this is what's going to be really interesting. But first, just some laying of the groundwork for what this is going to look like. So what this college football playoff situation looks like is the six highest-ranked conference champions, being the five Power Five champions and the Group of Five. If the conference champion in the Power Five is not one of the higher-ranked team, is not the highest-ranked team in the conference, which, you know, there are some situations where that might not happen, but overall that should probably end up being the case. Those teams will make it to the college football playoff. We'll add six more at-large bids after the fact. And the top four teams, who would normally be the top four in the college football playoff, get rewarded with a first-round bye. So there would essentially be four rounds of playoff instead of two rounds of playoff. You have the initial wild card round, like the NFL playoffs. Then you would have the divisional round, the second round of quarterfinals, then the semifinals, conference championships, and the championship game, i.e. the Super Bowl. So the college football playoff is moving closer and closer towards that model, but unlike the NFL, who had to collectively bargain this fact, college football can just kind of do whatever the hell it wants in creating its college football playoff system. So in the near future, we might see some rule changes, rule proposals, whatever it is that we want to call it, but it might not happen next year. They're just going to make the proposal now, which is where I want to get into on the timing of this situation, because the college football playoff is presently at four teams. It's been at four teams for a while, and part of this expansion process likely has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic, not for the NCAA, but for the individual conferences themselves, because remember, the television dollars for March Madness is collected by the NCAA and distributed to the member conferences. The revenue for the college football playoff is the domain of the Power Five conferences. Each of those conferences collect the revenue, generate it into a pool, and then distribute it to the remaining schools, the member schools. Each conference gets an XYZ amount of value, and they get the television dollars. They negotiate the television revenue with ESPN. Which I think ESPN pays close to $1 billion for the college football playoff. I don't know exactly what the number is, but I think it's somewhere in like the $600 to $700 million range each year for the college football playoff. But anyways, that's revenue that goes to just the Power Five schools, not to the NCAA, which would then distribute based on how much money each of the conferences make. And the funding for the NCAA is distributed by conference, not by school, intentionally meant to keep any of these individual schools and therefore the players will not ever get access to like large sums of money at each of these programs. It's about equal distribution from college basketball. The advantages come from private funding. College basketball is socialism in the distribution of money, intentionally meant to keep all the kids poorer, because they don't have the finances to end up actually making any significant leaps for the university. So anyways, that's the system backstory. What's interesting about the timing is the COVID-19 pandemic. And a lot of schools that, while they ultimately did end up weathering the storm of the pandemic and the NCAA distributing an additional, I think it was $25 million to member schools from reserve funds to make up for losses at the end of the year, much like a lot of these European soccer clubs, like the NCAA kind of needs some financial buoyancy here. And this is part of the intrigue of going down the path that the NCAA has gone down in talking about expanding the playoffs, which is the math around all of this is about to change very, very quickly. And so with the pandemic coming around, the NCAA looked up and said, or I'm sorry, the member conferences looked up and said, if expansion is inevitable in the end, and we have conversations every year about the Pac-12 and the Group of Five, why don't we go ahead and push forward with an expanded playoffs? And so one of the outcomes of pushing forward with an expanded playoffs is you're going to have the NCAA and its, you know, additional member conferences. The Group of Five and its schools look up and say, we need additional revenue, and this is an easy way to do it because each of these games add stakes to it. And one of the things we talk about in sports, or at least I've talked about from the sociological standpoint of sports, is that what drives interest to sporting events are stakes and storylines. And for regional sports like college football, which is very, very much a regional sport, when we talk about niche sports, it's more something that people like are interested in, but college football could be described as a national sport. There's a pastime to college football being a national sport and with a ton of national intrigue, but also college football is in a place where college football is in a place where they have now become an increasingly regional sport, to the point where they're pretty much just an entirely regional sport. And it's never more so than the South and the Midwest and, you know, Florida being its own region, which has some ties to the SEC. It's obviously Southeast, but Florida being its own region for college football and the West Coast being virtually abandoned. And the ACC obviously has the Florida States and the Clemsons and the Notre Dames being Midwest. But anyways, it's a very regional sport. And the plains like Oklahoma and Texas and Oklahoma, those are obviously regions that each have their own interest, own styles, own niches around college football. And so college football as a regional sport generates national interest when we create stakes and storylines. For example, I'm going to connect this to something that is personally near and dear to my heart. Why am I connecting this to Instagram? Because, of course, we run comical sports memes with close to 50,000 50,000 followers on Instagram, which you all can check out and support in our march all the way to 50,000. We're really about 15 away from hitting 49,000. So let's shoot for that goal and then get to the 50,000 marker. But what I wanted to point to that is a few of our most popular posts ever around college football. I think that the Justin Fields Clemson game last year was just hugely exciting for everyone who was tuning into it. And it was like a stake storyline bonanza because you had Justin Fields, Trevor Lawrence, at the time, the two best quarterbacks in college football, the presumptive number one and number two picks. And Trevor Lawrence had beaten Justin Fields last year. And Justin Fields was playing with a hip injury and he threw more touchdowns than incompletions and had a perfect passer rating and beat Clemson. And everyone wanted to see Clemson lose because Clemson kind of became a villain across the last 5 years. And Alabama, being as overwhelming as they are, generated a lot of interest because a lot of people like watching Notre Dame lose, and Notre Dame did end up losing. And so this creates an interesting national attention to college football because of the stakes and the storylines. People know Nick Saban. They know Dabo Swinney. They know the participants enough in the sport on a casual basis, but don't follow it to an extreme niche level. And some people follow it because it's their school, whether it's our buddy Blake with Kentucky or Boston College or Wake Forest, who has never won more than 8 games but never lost more than 9 in the last 20 years of football. People sometimes just root for their team and their conference and their sport. But that's not the case for everybody. And it's not the case for everybody because the sport as a whole has basically abandoned the West Coast. Like Najee Harris is one good example. He's from San Francisco Bay Area and went to Alabama. And there hasn't been a great West Coast team besides Oregon in a long time. And by the way, Oregon is only the program it is because of the Nike money. Like Chip Kelly ended up leaving Oregon to go to the NFL, when now I think you'd have to think twice to leave Oregon for the NFL only because of how much Nike money is invested in that Oregon program. So Oregon has a good football team every year. They have a really good basketball team as well because they get the kind of funding for their program that competes with the Alabamas, Texas A&M. And Texas A&M is, by the way, the most highly donated and funded school in collegiate football, despite the fact that they haven't really had a great season besides last year, which even though the Texas A&M program exists to lose to LSU and Auburn and be fourth in the SEC West. That turned around last year because LSU and Auburn both fell off a cliff and Gus Malzahn got fired, and Ed Orgeron probably should have been fired for non-football reasons about what was going on at that school. So, anyways, back to this. So the West Coast has basically abandoned in the college football landscape, and you have schools like Clemson and Alabama and Ohio State who, yes, they make the playoffs every year, but they've also become villains of the sport, and there's not a lot of heroes to counterbalance that, like Tim Tebow. Tim Tebow was one of those cases. Why do people still care about Tim Tebow now? Because Tim Tebow was bigger than the sport when he was at Florida and those teams won 2 national championships and he won a Heisman Trophy. And Tim Tebow was bigger than the sport, and Cam Newton was unbelievably good as a byproduct of that when he went to Auburn. And Tua Tagovailoa was a revelation when he came in the national championship game. But anyways, it was the storylines that drew people nationally into college football. And college football has just enough of a backstory that the stakes and storylines create interesting playoffs, or at the very least, at least one interesting playoff game every single year, whether it's Baker Mayfield going to, well, I should say it like Joe Tessitore, Baker Mayfield going to double overtime against Georgia at the Rose Bowl, and that game that was like one of the greatest college football games ever played, but the intrigue of the storylines and the stakes around the playoffs, or Joe Burrow throwing 7 first-half touchdowns against Oklahoma, or the Justin Fields game last year, or Tua coming in to win the national championship. There are stakes around college football, so why not add more stakes to college football? And that's a long-winded way to say, if you create more stakes and more storylines, it's better for the sport, and each of those stakes and storyline games not only lead to eyeballs, but eyeballs in turn lead to revenue, because you can sell ads on games where eyeballs are going to be turned in. And the problem for niche sports is only when you lose the stakes and storylines, which can sometimes be watered down. I'm guessing these wild card games, while they'll be super interesting in a tournament style play, it's like with basketball right now. Across a month, people can't keep up the intensity of a one-game win or go home. The problem for college football is that people didn't care about the one-game win or go home on a national level the way that they had intended when ESPN paid $600 to $750 million for the college football playoff. Yes, you're going to get a lot of eyeballs, but just not what you expect or had come to expect from previous college football seasons. And so with the pandemic, with the fact that ESPN is probably not happy with their playoff coverage, and a lot of it was trial and error. They tried going up against Dick in New Year's Eve one year. Michigan State got shut out by Alabama. It was one of the lowest-rated college football championship games in history. So they learned. They adapted, and they learned from their mistakes, and they got better about it. Now they play, like, on December 29th or something, or on a Friday or on a Saturday. They've gotten smarter about how they do the math on college football playoffs. And now that evolution is going to be doing an extended tournament and doing it with 5 teams, or doing it with 5 games a week, whatever it might end up being. That's the next evolution of the college football playoff. And so it might not be now, but this is something that was inevitable. But I think, as I was talking about a little bit ago, the timing of it, I feel, has to do with the pandemic and the fact that you are weathering an interesting storm unlike anything you've seen in the sport or in the world for the past 50-plus years. It's a unique storm that they weathered pretty well. Like, college football, for all of their faults, and for a year ago now, talking about how college football was really messing things up, they ended up doing all right, even though a lot of games got canceled and, you know, 80% of the games were played without a hitch, which I'd say is pretty bad. But to be honest, you know what you're getting from college football. Not only because college football is a traditionalist sport and you're going to get a lot of hand-me-down college football and hand-me-down fans across generations who, you know, often their parents rooted for the same team and their parents' parents rooted for the same team. And you put a lot of your emotional stability in a school that does not have any connection to you, or you did not attend, or no one in your family attended. It's a weird thing about college football and the large amount of emotional stability that gets put in Wake Forest never winning more than 8 games across 20 years. But what's interesting about college football from that standpoint is you have a lot of traditionalism, but also college football very much leans to the right of the political spectrum. How do we know this? If you ever needed, well, first of all, just look at the amount of white people in power in that sport and the fact that they push a lot of traditionalist ideals and the states and the cities that these schools play in. It plays a lot into regional politics, but also Donald Trump used college football as a bargaining chip to get COVID restrictions lifted in the event of his reelection campaign. he pushed the Big Ten to start football with the efforts of, you know, Justin Fields' grassroots movement and the parents of these places trying to get it going and the fan bases promising in swing states like Ohio, Iowa, Nebraska, Michigan, Wisconsin. Donald Trump pointed to that and said, what is an issue I can rally around for positive publicity in these states? Let's bring back college football. And that's why after the Big Ten reversed their decision, played a truncated season and was kind of behind the eight ball on the COVID stuff, because when they canceled the season and the Pac-12 canceled the season, the ACC, the SEC, and the Big 12 told them to pound sand because of regional politics. They ended up caving. They ended up starting their season, and we got a full playoff. It's something we shouldn't forget about the regional politics of this sport. And it's a reason why I didn't watch very much college football last year, because it's not a sport and it's not an activity that I would want to commit all of my Saturdays to, especially being in college and being at a point in my life where my Saturdays don't have to include a lot of college football anymore. And I was much happier with that mantra, even if there wasn't a lot going on. So to my point on college football, leans to the right politically, very traditionalist sport, but the money definitely talks. They are very active in recognizing that the money talks and the math changes on the sport as soon as you point to where can we fund a new college football season in, and where can we fund a college football playoff that brings in publicity. And this was a matter of time, but I think the pandemic and the events that went down across the last 6 months prior to these 6 months, so from like June of last year, basically starting with Mike Gundy saying that we should be, you know, sacrificing young people because he got a little toxic internet brain from watching too much OAN, to the strength coach for Iowa getting fired, to the awkward Chuba Hubbard Mike Gundy hand clasp, to the Florida State coach who may have lied to some players and some captains called him out on his shit. From that point until about the college football playoff, I think the changing landscape of college football and the fact that, you know, Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern and PJ Fleck and all these guys are trying to make a jump to the NFL, but the changing landscape of college football makes it such that a lot of coaches want to make that jump to the NFL, like our buddy Matt Campbell should have. We talked about that a while ago, where he didn't take the offer from the Detroit Lions. The situation in college football is changing very quickly. And for a traditionalist sport, they don't take change very well, and they're going to fight against change. It's why we talked about that name, image, and likeness law in Georgia that was kind of messed up, because Georgia wants to take money earned over name, image, and likeness and pool it and distribute it to everyone, because ultimately that's a way to adapt with the times but also maintain the structures that keep kids broke. Even if it's not shamaturism that they're protecting, it becomes equality in name, image, and likeness as the pivot to try and keep the kids broke and maintain the system that they've had so far, so that they don't earn any real money and don't earn any real power, and keep it such that in a time like a pandemic, they can come together, organize a 12-team college football playoff, collect all of the revenue from ESPN and not distribute it with the players, or have to collectively bargain a 12-game season, maintaining the power of management over kids that don't have any real power. As a collective, don't have any real bargaining power. Now you fight for things, and people with actual power and influence are fighting on your behalf a lot of the times, like getting the one-year transfer rule passed, which we talked about before. That was the efforts of kids and people in positions of, or fighting positions of power, to get the right to have a one-time transfer rule, which changed the rules around college football and gave just a semblance more of power to the kids over the staff. There's a reason that administrators and coaches overwhelmingly fought the one-year transfer rule, because otherwise kids have to fall in line if there is no other option besides what you're doing. It is the exact same model used in pretty much all sorts of forced labor. If you remove all of the alternative options, that person becomes accustomed to the torment that they are going through, or in the case, just whatever conditions they're working through, and they adapt, and for better or for worse of the human being, there is no out route. So the one-year transfer rule is a step in the right direction. It's not perfect, but it's still a step in the right direction that was fought for across a decade to allow kids some semblance of leverage and some semblance of power in negotiating tactics and in their college decisions, because ultimately they have a free agency opportunity if they so take it. All of this is to say college football loves maintaining that hierarchy. It's why it's a traditionalist sport. It was a sport that was built on TV revenue based on whether or not you appeared on nationally televised games. You did not have to split the revenues among conferences or the NCAA. And it's a model that they hoped to protect. It ended up being broken down. They had to renegotiate. And after BCS and all the BS that went through the BSCS, which I just kind of like that. I just came up with that right now, calling it the BSCS, and everything that's gone down over the past few years. Now you have a college football playoff negotiated by the conferences that they can expand at any time, which they're choosing to do now, changes all of the math behind this conversation, because now you add more stakes and storylines to games, generate more ad revenue at a drastically changing time in the sports. And the timing of the change in the sport is coincided with everything being sped up by the COVID-19 pandemic, even if they ended up getting a full season in for most of these teams, or at least a portion of these teams got most of a full season in. I know games got canceled and the Big Ten only played 8 games, but even though there was from the outside looking in, only minimal hiccups towards the COVID pandemic, the pandemic sped up all of this stuff that is now leading to ultimately, as reported today, a 12-team college football playoff. So thank you to everyone who stopped in on YouTube. We're going to stop the YouTube now and transition over to our buddy Chris Clark from 10 Sports. Check him out on Instagram at 10 Sports for lots of good Tennessee Titans coverage. He's always fantastic when he comes on the podcast. And we're going to take a quick break here on radio, and we will be right back with our friend Chris Clark of 10 Sports. We'll talk to you guys in just a second. Welcome back, everybody. We are here on the Take It Easy radio show. Part two today is a conversation with our friend Chris from 10 Sports about the Julio Jones trade. So let's welcome our buddy Chris in now to the Take It Easy radio show.
are you today?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm feeling good. How about that? So we got some exciting Titans news going on here. It's good to hear from you again.
Yeah, Titans, after a little suspect offseason, they found a way to get back in it.
Yeah. Well, they kind of got back to a net zero because I was doing the math on it. It's like you have to replace 1,000 Corey Davis yards and you have to replace about 700 Jonnu Smith yards. Julio Jones and Josh Reynolds and the return of Adam Humphries might be just enough to do it for you.
Yeah. I think Julio's a huge upgrade over Corey Davis.
Thing
about Jonnu Smith is I think he was more so a product of Tannehill than it was the other way around. I think Tannehill is underrated when it comes to the point of being able to put his teammates in a position to succeed. Look at Corey Davis as an example. The dude didn't have good years in Tennessee up until Tannehill was quarterback. So I like where we are. I don't think losing Corey and Jonnu was that big of a deal to start with, but now that we got Julio, it's definitely not a big deal.
I forgot to mention off the top, our buddy 10 Sports, check him out on Instagram. We've been doing these for like a year now, just on and off whenever there's something cool going on with the Titans or
yeah.
Nashville Predators, even though they didn't have very much cool going on this year. But we, check out 10 Sports on Instagram. So basically, with the restructuring of the contract, y'all got Julio Jones for a second-round pick, and it didn't really cost anything relative to the cap, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
One, considering that it was easy, all they had to do was restructure Tannehill's deal, but two, that they didn't do it beforehand. It headed into free agency.
Yeah. Titan GM, once again, working miracles throughout here. The funny thing about it is I don't think they had to consult Tannehill for his permission. Of course, they had to talk to him and say, hey, here's what we're doing, so he's aware, but I think they could have done it no matter what. Even if Tannehill didn't want to do it, they could have done it regardless. I don't know if Tannehill would have said no anyway, because always they're converting his salary money into his money into, I think, his signing bonus. So it's pretty much guaranteed now, but spread out over a few years. So great work by Jonah Robinson to make this happen. Second offseason in a row, he's done something that pleases the fan base. So doing his job well.
Yeah, and no, never is Julio Jones a bad thing, no matter how old or how injured or whatever. I don't think there's any possible way, given that all they had to give up was a mid to late second round pick to get him. I don't think there's any way that this backfires for the Titans, because all of it is basically you just get another one of these super freak humans into that locker room with AJ Brown and Derrick Henry, and at the very least, it's better than what you had before. And I don't know how valuable that second-round pick really is to the Titans at this point.
It seems like they're going all in. They revamped the defense. It's really going to come down to the defense this year. They revamped it, and they pretty much kept the offense intact with the players. I have said earlier, no disrespect to Jonnu Smith, but he had 8 touchdowns, which was not huge, but he wasn't as huge of a factor in our offense. People think because he was spending a lot of time injured, our backup kind of had to step up. So offense is still there, and they're going all in this year. It's like they're going for a Super Bowl this year. So that second round pick won't mean anything if we win a Super Bowl. So I think it's a good move.
And nor will the extra like $15 million there. You mentioned the defense. I don't think we got to talk about Bud Dupree, because that was a genuinely shocking signing in free agency, where I saw that I was like, wow, that was out of nowhere, $16 million a year for 5 years to Bud Dupree to solidify that linebacker position. They'd been battling with trying to get it right for a while, and, it was a big move for the Tennessee Titans to make and a huge financial commitment. But maybe this, after, like, trying with Jadeveon Clowney and trying with, I don't even know who it was, Vic Beasley. Now they're pretty much saying, all right, let's go all in and pay one of the biggest linebacker contracts in the NFL. I thought that was a under-the-radar shocking move that the Titans made before this.
Yeah. I like the Bud Dupree move. simply because I think Bud Dupree is going to come in here and do better than Jadeveon Clowney did. I think Jadeveon Clowney move, even though I want it to happen.
Good morning.
Good.
It's what they want to, because they signed players that fit that man coverage mold. Caleb Farley was regarded as a good man coverage. You know, he plays zone. He's regarded as a good man coverage corner coming in the draft. You know, Rasinghe's a good man coverage corner. They've made moves to the point where you feel like at some point they decided, like, we're going to go to a man defense. I'm not exactly sure why they decided to change it that way. I mean, obviously, zone defense wasn't working very well for him, so that's probably why. But this is what Mike Vrabel wants to do. And I'm just happy that Mike Vrabel's making the changes, because people call him stubborn. I don't think he's that stubborn. I think he's a smart guy. He may act stubborn, but I think he's a smart guy. He's probably like, you know what, I got to change something up, but it's not working for me. So,
why would he get the reputation of stubborn? I can't even think of why he would get that reputation.
Last year, here's a sequence of events. First off, if you ever want to watch one of his press conferences, just take a note of the tone that he has when he talks. He just has this kind of like, he has a tone like, if you didn't know any better, you would think he's won like 20 Super Bowls and he's like a legend.
Yeah, he wants to like intimidate you.
He
speaks like he wants to intimidate you at every turn.
Yeah, and he likes to have like a smart, this sarcastic tone with the reporter. So reporters sometimes clash with him. They tweet about him like how arrogant he is, whatever. There's that. And then it's like whenever they act like last year when we had a horrible defense and it was pretty obvious our defense was horrible, and the reporters will ask him, you know, what do you think about the system that you have going on? Well, last year it was like we didn't have a defensive coordinator. Everybody knew it was Shane Bowen, but Vrabel.
Hello, hello, hello. Sorry about that, folks. We had a little bit of a situation right there, but my phone died. That's the situation that we had. Sorry about that. Let us get back rolling here with our friend, 10 Sports. Sorry about that quick problem. We should be good to go the rest of the way.
Another reason why they call him stubborn, and the last reason is the scout situation. When he started out horrible, even though he won us 3 games, he is horrible. Vrabel refused to deal up on him. And
I was just thinking while you were going through that. So you had Bud Dupree, you've got Simmons, you got Danico Autry. Is Harold Landry the other one in the 4-3, or do you guys run the 3-4 defense?
I think Titans is a – well, I know Titans are a base 3-4 defense, but they do a lot of different formations. Like, they may come out in the base 3-4, but they'll show different looks. Like, so it's kind of hard to say that they are just a 3-4 defense. Yes, Harold Andrew is the other guy opposite of Bud Dupree. And then, miraculously, we kept J.R. Brown. That helps a lot. So, linebacker core is looking great, and that defensive front is looking really good. So, I'm excited to see how it translates onto the field.
Do you think the defense is going to be better this year than last year, or do you think that the Adoree Jackson, Malcolm Butler losses are going to be a bit much to hurt the secondary a bit?
I feel like they may miss Malcolm. I don't think they're going to miss Adoree too much. Adoree was good at times, but he was mostly a liability. But he was good at times. I give him his credit. There were times we were facing a guy like Tyreek Hill, and he was able to hold him as long as he could, you know. But Adoree is mostly a liability with injuries and his mistakes that he makes. But Malcolm is really good. We'll definitely miss that. I know the Titans didn't want to make that move because, yes, I said they're going to a man defense. Malcolm can play man. Like, he can play whatever you want to play. So they're going to miss that. But I think that really comes down to if Farley and Christian Fulton can step up. I have faith that Denora Zingas will. He's a veteran. He's been doing it for a while. He's been one of the most consistent players in the league over the last decade.
I keep forgetting Janoris Jenkins is there. That happened on a podcast a while ago before the NFL draft where we were talking about the Titans pick at 22. I was like, Oh, shit, that's right. They have Janoris Jenkins. I keep forgetting that Janoris Jenkins is a Titan now.
Yeah, he's one of the most consistent players in the league, so I have confidence he'll be okay. Maybe it just comes down to Farley and Fulton. If they can step up, if one of them can step up, we'll be fine. I have confidence in Byard as well. And question about Imani Hooker, if he can step in the role that Kenny Vaccaro did, but Imani has looked good in the last couple of years in his role that he played. Now he's going to play a bigger role, so hopefully he can step up and play that bigger role well. But I think the secondary has potential. It just comes down to Fulton and Farley. It really does. They can play well. We won't miss them.
Are the Titans offensively going to run three receiver sets this year? I know, obviously, Arthur Smith is gone now, and I don't know if they're going to keep running the same system or not because of the workload Derrick Henry's had over the last two seasons. That was a crazy stat I saw. Derrick Henry's had 800 carries in the last two seasons.
Yeah. That's one reason why I think Khalil Murray is big, because now, I'll get to that later, but it's just now that they can be more versatile. But to answer your question, I think they can run three. I think they kind of have to run more three receivers sets because Josh Reynolds always has the potential or the threat of going deep and beating you deep. He has good speed. Great.
Yeah, he's a true slot receiver. Josh Reynolds is a true slot receiver.
And with A.J. Brown and Josh and Julio Jones on the other side, now you got to account for Josh Reynolds too. So it's going to make it really hard to stop tight passing game if they do run a three set. And also, not to mention, with that three set, they can run a spread offense, spread the defense out, and let Derrick Henry get through the middle. So, I think they kind of have to. They can't run two receiver sets anymore, like Arthur did. They kind of have to go towards the direction of a spread offense if they want to be. They want to utilize these players to their best potential. So I'm excited to see what they do. I think Todd Downing, the new offensive coordinator, he has all the pressures on him. He can't screw this up. If he screws this up, he's going to go down probably to one of the worst coordinators in history because you can't screw this up. You have so many superstars on your team.
You have so many superstars and a window that is technically still open, but like teams are improving and the Titans are kind of staying put. And that's why the Julio Jones move just made too much sense for me. It's like all these teams are getting better and the Titans needed to do something to, you know, kind of push themselves over the edge in the arms race of the AFC.
And they did it. They did it. So it's just a matter of really the biggest question is, can Julio stay healthy? Can Todd Downing utilize what he has to his full advantage? Because there's been a lot of times where good teams kind of got bogged down by horrible coaching.
Even with the coaching situation, you can screw up this fact because you know you have this. We talked before, just freak, gigantic running back that can also break away from elite athletes.
Yeah.
But his body is not going to last forever. It's just a question of how much can he last. And we have some sample to figure it out just from other running backs. Not that Derrick Henry is other running backs, but, yeah, when guys average 400 carries across two seasons and play, I think he took like 111 snaps in four playoff games, or I'm sorry, 111 carries in four playoff games across the last 2 years. Like, at a certain point, you just look up and say, man, that guy is a bruiser who, might, at the very least, might have to change the way he runs to avoid contact at some point. I just don't know when that point is.
Yeah, I think Derrick Henry is different in terms of how he's built and how he prepares himself. That's why I think Derrick has been able to take these carries and literally not take a step back. Like, the only time I've seen him get injured over the last 2 years was when he had ran into, it was a Steelers linebacker at the 1 yard line. He ran up the middle and Steelers linebacker caught him. And Derrick showed a little bit of something, but then he just got back up and ran again. And the Steelers linebacker was the one that had no sideline. So that's the only time I saw Derrick Henry have any kind of injury. There was one kind of scare where he had a hamstring. But it wasn't serious, and they just kept him out of the Saints game because it didn't matter. That game didn't matter at all in terms of our playoff chances, so they kept him out of the game. That's the only time I've seen him get hurt. The guy's different. So I'm not saying he won't, regress because it's going to happen eventually. but I don't think it's going to happen. As some people think it's going to happen.
I agree with you on that, because I have no reason, looking at this right now, I have no reason to believe he can't go for 2,000 yards again next year. Like, there's just nothing I'm seeing that says he's going to go down, other than just precedent of running backs declining, but he got even better into his fifth year than he did in his fourth year.
Yeah, and one thing, somebody had DM'd my page and asked me, do you think Derek can go 2K again? And I told him, I said, it's never happened, it probably never will. I don't think so, but
if he can lead the league in rushing yards, they're fine.
yeah, and that, and honestly, the more I think about it, the more I feel like now we got Julio, it could happen. Seriously, it can happen. Like, but it goes back to what I said I was going to lose to, I was going to get to later, and that is this. And it kind of touches on that and Derek's carry total. Now they have Julio. They can – the OC can literally choose a different game plan each week. You got so many weapons in your offense. Now when you face Titans, you're not – it's not like, oh, you know they're going to run the ball with Derek Henry no matter what. No, like literally, we can come out one day and say, we're going to be a packaging today, and we're going to air it out to AJ and Julio and Josh Reynolds, and Derek might get like 12, 13 carries just to kind of salvage his you know, mouth a little bit. But Derek feeling those 12, 13 carries might still get a solid 90 yards, because now you're like, oh, they're coming out throwing the ball. Let's put two safeties up. Oh, we're going to just run Derek Henry and force you to stay honest. You know what I'm saying? So they can literally choose a game plan each week. If this OC can coach, he can have fun with this. He can say, okay, this week I want to be a passing team. Okay, this week I want to be a running team. Okay, this week I want to be a little bit of both. Let's be balanced, you know. And then it keeps opponents guessing what should we prepare for when we face Titans this week. And that's a nightmare for coaches. I already know. So,
well, that's one of the beauties of football, is that you're literally playing the opponent a lot of the times.
Yeah.
A lot of the times you have to scheme around what the other team is doing, and teams have to scheme to what personnel they're playing. And game plans can change week to week to week. Almost entirely how you play the game.
Yeah, and also, if you want to go to a fantasy standpoint, that kind of makes the Titans a little scary option in fantasy, because you just don't know. I still think the most reliable piece in fantasy, if you want to get a Titan, is Derrick Henry. He's going to get his touches, and he's going to get his touchdowns. But you just never know. Like, one week, it might be Julio going off. One week it might be Josh Reynolds. One week it might be AJ. You never know. So you got to be weary of that. But it's going to be fun offense. Like, we're not going to know what to expect week in and week out, unless this OC is horrible and predictable, which would be a failure. But I'm excited to see what happens. I'm excited for the week one, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, against the Cardinals, nonetheless. That's going to make it even more interesting.
That's going to be a big game.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun 1 o'clock week one game. I'm super excited. It's like, yeah, during the 9 red zone games, but that's one that I'm like, this one is going to be interesting to see, because both of those teams are going to look so different year over year. So
yeah,
that's going to be cool to watch. Titans and Cardinals, both kind of at the same stages of their franchise, right? Like, this is year 3 of their current iteration. They want to really take a big leap this year and put themselves over the edge, and they've made the move to do that. You're right.
Yep.
That is going to be a really fun game.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing to watch. And it's going to be nerve-wracking. I'm a Titans fan, but it's going to be fun. I think that's going to be it's an early test for our defense. Especially DeAndre Hopkins, Kyler Murray, Andy Isabella's a speedster.
A.J. Green is there now.
A.J. Green, they have a good running back. I think it's got, I want to say it's – who's it? I want to say Kenyon Drake. I don't know the name.
No, it's not Kenyon Drake. It's James Conner.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be a tough test with Titans defense first right off the bat, and then we got Russell Wilson right after that. So, early test, and I said this on my – I go live on TMS every Thursday, and I said this last week. I said, I think the defense is going to struggle coming out because they're facing top-tier players early on, and this is a pretty new revamped defense. Like, literally, a lot of these guys – I think we have, like, what, I forget the number, but a high percentage of players that are starting for our defense now did not start for us last year. So they're new. They got to deal together. They'll have training camp to do that now that, you know, we're in a normal year. We're not virtual. So hopefully that helps. But, you know, have 3 preseason games. But that week one game is going to be a true test for them to kind of see who they are I think they're going to struggle right off the bat. I think they'll finally start to get it around like week 5 or 6, and that's when things start to click. So hopefully the first 5 weeks our offense can carry us a little bit.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Thursday, because that's when this podcast is going to air. So if you're listening to this right now, make sure to follow 10 Sports so you can see him go live on Instagram today, or maybe it's already happened, at which point you can check out next week, I guess.
it'll be saved on my page, so you can definitely just watch it, watch the rerun of it. But yeah, I just go live. I had Derek Mason, former Titan, on there 1 week. This week I won't have a guest. It'll be me. But
ooh, that's awesome. Derek Mason, that's kind of awesome.
Pretty cool guy. Pretty cool guy.
Nice. Well, thank you again for coming on. I really appreciate it. And until the next big Titans news, enjoy yourself, and thank you again. I'm glad we got to catch up here today.
No problem. I'm hearing a lot of Melvin Ingram rumors, so we get him. I'll buy you back on.
That would be interesting, because I'm a big Harold Landry guy, only because he was our 2019 preseason Hall of Famer on the defensive side of the ball, and all of those guys that win that award, I try to follow their careers. So I believe in Harold Landry, but I can't say no to Melvin Ingram. That would be a great pickup for the Tennessee Titans.
Yeah, real quick, right now the rumors, like, it's not official, but it's just whispers, but, you know, what they say, we're a smoke, there's fire, so.
Yeah, I've heard Raiders, and I've heard back to the Chargers for him, but the Titans would be interesting. Because, mm-hmm. like you said, that defense has basically an all-new cast of characters, so might as well see what you can get out of him. Vic Beasley didn't work out as well, but maybe Melvin Ingram will work a whole lot better.
Right, and have Bud Dupree. That'd be great. Hopefully it happens, but we'll see.
We'll see. Maybe we'll chat again sooner than we think. But thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, that has been 10 Sports, and this has been the Take It Easy Radio Show here on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. Make sure to follow on Instagram, Comical Sports Meme, Take It Easy Podcast, and Open Talk Radio. Take it easy, everybody. We'll talk to you again next week.